And good afternoon. This is WFPL's Here and Now. I'm Jonathan Bastian. It's 1:40, and thanks for being with us. Well, we've wrapped up a long political season right now with the elections finally over, and we now have an opportunity to take a step back and say, what does it all mean? I'm joined right now by Associate Professor of Political Science, Jasmine Ferrier, and she's going to be speaking tomorrow at the Filson Historical Society at noon. And the title of the talk is The Enduring Impact of a Presidential Election. Well, Jasmine, thanks for coming down here today. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Give us a sense of your talk tomorrow. It sounds like some pretty fitting, of course, in the times right now.
Well, presidential elections seem to shake up the landscape immediately, but the full impact of presidential elections is really in a much more complex constitutional context. So, for example, we do have a House of Representatives and we do have a Senate. They will be on different sides of the aisle themselves, and we see now the type of gridlock that will be enduring.
Right. So you look at this, especially, as you said, there are many different branches of government, and they all have elections throughout the year, but we seem to create these narratives of it's the presidential election that will determine the way we think about this current period of time, but it's more complicated than that.
Yeah, so our political culture is very president-centric.
Right.
And presidents do not necessarily dissuade us from believing that they are the center of the political universe. But of course, soon after the election, when the dust settles, we do notice that there are two other co-equal branches. That would be the Congress and the Supreme Court, and they do not follow the same clock for elections.
Right. So when you look back, historically speaking, what are some examples of this that you're talking about and of the different stories that we think about now?
Well, first, I'd say let's go back to the original Constitution, and we have to decide for ourselves how the Constitution is relevant to day-to-day political life. Sometimes we think of the Constitution as a dusty document that we need to learn for the sake of history or philosophy, but that it may not be relevant. Sometimes we argue about constitutional powers. Sometimes we argue about individual rights. But the truth is, the heart of the Constitution is the structural dynamics of separation of powers. The Constitution is vague or ambiguous on many things. It is not vague or ambiguous on election cycles. So, for example, the House of Representatives is elected every 2 years. Every single one of them is up for re-election by their local district. What that means is that the founders wanted there to be a constant energy in the House of Representatives that was locally infused. So local constituencies tell their House members what it is they want. When those House members arrive, they believe they have the right to be there.
Right.
The House of Representatives is dominated by the Republican Party right now, and it will continue to be majority dominated by the Republican Party in January.
Right.
Every single person in the House won their election. They do not necessarily see the need for compromise that the rest of the political system might see. Then let's look at the Senate. The Senate's elected, obviously, every 6 years. It was originally indirectly elected, but after the 17th Amendment, it is now elected by the voters of the states. But the Constitution says only one-third of the Senate is up for election every 2 years, so everybody serves their six-year term, but they're on a staggered clock. For that reason, no two senators in Kentucky are ever up at the same year, nor would be for any other state. Well, why would that be? Why would they create one chamber of locally elected representatives, one chamber of originally state-elected representatives on a different clock? And both of those clocks are different from the president. And what about the Supreme Court? We do not know when the next justice will die or retire. So that's very much up for their own decision. So in other words, the president faces a much more complex political landscape than sometimes we are led to believe.
Can you think of situations where a president came, a big name president was elected in, and with huge sweeping ideas to govern, but essentially might have almost just been forgotten about historically because was dealing with, as you said, this complex system of the different elements of government?
Well, sure. Well, first, let's think about the big sweeping presidents, because even though the Constitution is designed to scatter power, to fragment power, in part to not allow it to be concentrated, there is another outside the Constitution phenomenon called political parties, which is going to glue that back together. So remember, parties are not in the Constitution. Parties are a development that may have happened very naturally and certainly happened very early, but parties are supposed to glue it back together. So how are all these representatives and senators who are coming from all across the country going to see the world through similar lenses? And the answer is party. So obviously, there are some elections that are much more vibrant in a party way than others. We can think about the 1932 election that elected Franklin Roosevelt. And we can also think about the 1964 election that reelected President Johnson. Both of those presidents faced very strong Democratic-dominated House and Senate. Let's think more recently about the middle 4 years of the George W. Bush administration, where he had solid Republican majorities in the House and Senate. Under these unusual circumstances, we almost have a parliamentary system where we do have a president who can act like a prime minister and largely govern his majority. But your question was about a more complicated system. Let's think about two living ex-presidents who faced different kinds of Congresses, and that would be George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton. Their legacies are still being written. Both of them faced opposition party Congresses, and both have been revived in recent years for their accomplishments.
Well, thinking about that question of legacy, that's interesting. Do you, as a historian, get a sense of when we really begin to understand the legacy of a certain political era or a president?
That's a great question. To be perfectly honest, as somebody who was alive in the 90s as an adult watching the political scene unfold, I have been very surprised about how Bill Clinton has been treated by the Democratic Party and by the Republican Party. As if the impeachment scandal did not happen, as if the Republican Party did not try to undo an election to literally throw him out of office outside the clock, something that's never happened before. So there's this revisionism that we actually all got along in the 1990s, which is not true. And that actually goes back to Clinton's predecessor, George H.W. Bush. So Bush and Clinton deserve a lot of credit for having some legislative success with opposition Congresses. In fact, they both struggled mightily with these opposition Congresses to try to balance the budget. So what's interesting about the lesson from the 1990s is that although party politics and division were both as ugly as ever, politics was certainly not taking a backseat to principle. It was a very tough decade. We started with record deficits. We ended with a surplus. So I think that the founders, if they could look at this type of environment, would say that despite their best efforts to not concentrate power, they actually did succeed in forcing people who saw the political world differently to somehow compromise.
We'll be right back with Professor Jasmine Ferrier. We're going to take a short break, and you can hear her talk tomorrow at the Filson Historical Society at noon. This is Here and Now. And good afternoon. I'm Jonathan Bastian, and I'm joined right now by Associate Professor of Political Science from the University of Louisville, Jasmine Ferrier. She will be speaking tomorrow at the Filson Historical Society. The talk is entitled The Enduring Impact of a Presidential Election, and we've been discussing this over the last 10 minutes. And, you know, Jasmine, I was curious to think about, as you said, we're talking about the complexity of the political system in general and thinking about how these different legacies that come out of presidential elections. If you think about congressional elections, presidential elections, and again, the courts, which are a little trickier because especially the Supreme Court is assigned, which of those three ultimately do you think does make the greatest impact when we look back historically on different eras?
That's a tough question. My students would want me to tell you the difficult answer that I put on them, which is that we have these ongoing political policy and constitutional dialogues. And it sounds a little bit fancy, but it's much more accurate, I think, to say that we have these ongoing discussions about the same issues over and over again over a long period of time. Now, sometimes the issues get settled. So, for example, obviously, the issue of slavery was settled by the 13th Amendment and the Civil War. But what about the issue of desegregation? What about the issue of busing in Jefferson County today? These are ongoing court battles. These are ongoing state and local battles, as well as national questions. You can argue that the same is true about war powers. The same is true about abortion. If the court had really settled abortion in 1973, we wouldn't have been spending almost 40 years arguing about it.
Right. Well, let's look at the present day right now. As we said, we have Obama Part 2 on the way right now. How do you make sense of the first 4 years in terms of what we're talking about now, the intricacies of this system here? Will he be considered, do you think, so far as that term as being a healthcare term? How do you understand those first 4 years?
Well, I think it's hard to take a long-term view when you're enduring the political battles day to day, because it seems very frustrating to watch the news every day. And again, I would just reference the 90s. But looking back, we can see that both George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton had a lot of legislative accomplishments, even though it was a bit of an ugly fight to get there. We look back on, let's say, the Americans with Disabilities Act. that was passed and signed by George H.W. Bush. We can think about the 1990 budget agreement that actually set us on the path for surpluses by the end of the decade. For Bill Clinton, obviously, there are things you can disagree with, certainly welfare reform, Defense of Marriage Act, and the balanced budgets that he and Newt Gingrich hammered out. For the first 4 years of the Obama administration, we can think about health care, of course. We can also think about Dodd-Frank and the types of financial reforms that were put into place after the Wall Street meltdown. So I do think that we're going to continue to revise our assessment of not just the policies themselves, but the behavior of the main actors.
Yeah. Did anything strike you about this election? Of course, the Democrats thought this was a sweeping win, but the right and the Republicans are saying, well, we still have a lot of governors. We still have a lot of people in Congress. What did you notice this year?
Well, we are a divided electorate. Yeah. And if we think about the House and Senate being held by different parties, it is true that the president did better than many people thought he would as far as the electoral count. But sometimes that has to do with the weakness of the candidate on the other side rather than an overwhelming endorsement of his own policies. We have a largely 5-4 court. And these divisions reflect our divisions. But I think that we look at them perhaps in the opposite way that we should. Instead of thinking ourselves as a divided nation, we should think of how close we are. Because why else would we rock back and forth within the same two political parties that are actually not as far apart as they portray themselves as? So when we think about the 5-4 court, for example, well, where did that 5-4 come from? It came from the fact that voters over the past few decades have installed presidents of different parties and senates of different parties. Those 9 justices reflect those differences. The fact that they're 5-4 might not mean that they're that far apart. It might mean that we as a society are actually not clear what it is we want. And so we flirt back and forth, and hopefully we'll get something that's towards the middle.
Well, we have just about a minute left here, but I'm curious to know always what it's like coming from the professorial side. Can you ever detach your knowledge of history when you begin to look at these subjects? Are you always thinking past and present?
I look at the news every day and think of material for my classes. And it's not because I want them to be partisans. I try not to reveal any of my own opinions, and I certainly don't have any interest in hearing theirs. What I try to tell them is that self-government is a very, very, very tricky thing to pull off. And if we look at the Arab Spring and we look at new democracies like new stars around the world, we see that having a society that can govern itself when people disagree on things and have elections that are considered to be clean and fair. You notice Mitt Romney went to the White House for lunch. He didn't contest the authenticity of the election results. We take things for granted in this country that other countries are just beginning to understand.
Jasmine Ferrier is an associate professor of political science at the University of Louisville. Thank you so much for coming in today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.